Once again, we're going to start off with a brief presentation from Melissa Kane, our CBSSF political analyst. She's going to give you some honest-to-goodness, take-home, how-to advice, how to rig an election. Melissa?
Thanks for coming. I'll make this quick. I know we got a really good program lined up for you. But I talked to John about doing a program called How to Rig an Election because, frankly, it's sort of in the news, right? Everything's rigged. Everything I don't like is rigged. Everything that makes me look bad is rigged. The lighting in the dressing room, rigged. it's something that's on everyone's mind. And so, actually, if you Google rigged, you find out that apparently elections are the only thing less corrupt than the NBA. Apparently, there's rigged NBA. So what do we mean by rigged? Since rigged meaning is obviously the number one question, what do we mean? We mean an election whose result does not end up or does not reflect the popular will. Okay. So as we go forward, I want to talk to you about sort of two ways one could rig an election. And the reason I think this is important is because we worry about these things. We think about these things. And maybe sometimes we place our worries and our confidences in places that maybe we should rethink. And so we're going to talk about two places in the election process where you could kind of sneak in and cause some trouble. And then you guys can decide for yourselves sort of, you know, what do you think the likelihood is of rigging elections one way or the other? As you can see there, Donald Trump has recently asked for volunteers to be election observers. Now, I have not signed up for this, but I know... But John Oliver says that if you sign up for it, you get a fundraising email. So I don't know, like, what he means by observer, if he's, like, going to sell tickets or how that's going to work. But we're going to talk a little bit about election observers. So I'm going to quickly talk about California elections because I think, and I know you guys are super smart and you know all this stuff, but let's do a quick reminder. A quick reminder, there is no such thing as federal vote counting, right? There is no volcano with a tunnel under it where the ballots go, where the men in the suits, you know, count the ballots, right? That's not how it works, right? Every state just sort of reports their electoral votes to the federal government. And on the state level, the state doesn't count the ballots, right? The state just sits there and waits for you, for the counties to tell them what happened. And as proof of this, if an election is really close and one of the candidates wants a recount, the state doesn't even do the recount. The candidate has to say exactly which county and which precinct they want the recount in and pay for it, that's a different issue, and then have a recount. So again, there's no sort of statewide agency that oversees the actual ballot counting. It's all done locally. And that's really important because when we think about how do you rig an election on election day when you have literally thousands of different systems, thousands of different people, thousands of different machines. The other thing you should know that in California, this should give you some comfort, actually, our voting machines are terrible. Like they're outdated. They're very old. But the one good thing about having machines from 1996 is that there's no internet involved. If you want to hack a California voting machine, you got to be sitting next to it with like a speak and spell, like trying to like get in there. You really have to like physically be there. You cannot sit in your dorm room and hack a California voting machine. That is the truth. And remember, in California, there is a law that says if you want to have an electronic machine, local government, if you want to try that, you have to have a paper trail. And that's really important, right? Because in some states, like Georgia, FYI, which is going to be kind of a mess this year, if you have electronic voting and no paper trail, you can't audit. Georgia's voting machines, for example, have electronic voting but no paper trail. So if something weird were to happen, like say it flips for Hillary Clinton this year, no way to verify whether that was an actual movement of the voters or that was an actual rigging of the system. So The Secretary of State has to approve all the machines that are used by local governments. That's another sort of restriction on the machines that we can use. And it's they're very onerous, and it's not Alex Padilla's fault. It's a bunch of legal restrictions. So before any local government can use any machine, they have to get approval from the Secretary of State. And this is an enormous pain. Right now, there's only like six right, that are able to be used. And they're allowing some pilot programs, but in general, they're super stingy. So our voting machines are old and not connected to the internet. Getting new ones is going to be difficult. And when we do get new ones, there will be a paper trail. So when you think about rigging elections in California, understand that it's we're a lot safer actually than you know, the zeitgeist might lead us to believe. And in California, in San Francisco, for example, we use these machines. They look like paper shredders, actually. I always get a little weirded out when I put my ballot in. I'm like, is that going in the trash? It looks like a paper shredder. It's actually a scanner. We use the same machines that Oakland uses, right, because we all have RCV. So we actually, these are the same sort of little paper shredder scanners that can count the RCV. Now, in San Francisco, for example, they pick six precincts. They actually do a manual count. They count what does the cartridge on the scanner say, and then versus what the paper ballots say. So there's some serious checks and balances. The truth is, though, we vote so much by mail. San Francisco is like 60% vote by mail. Statewide, it's 70% vote by mail. And the truth is, if you really wanted to screw with the system, get the vote by mail votes, right? Create fake identities and have ballots sent to your house. That would be the way. The idea that observers are on election day are going to help you is not really that good of a plan. You'd really have to, just again, if you want to do this, absentee ballots are really the less sort of guarded way that we vote, that is a better way to, oh, hey, Howard. That would be the sort of way in. So again, when you're talking about elections in California, the observers are not the way to go. Oh, sorry. Ah, okay. So again, if you wanted to rig an election in California, you would have to do it county by county. It would have to be like a massive operation. And, you know, maybe there's apps for that. I don't know. But you'd have to really coordinate. It would have to be like on a grand scale. And you would have to, basically, if you wanted to destroy ballots, you'd have to destroy the cartridges and ballots. So you'd have to, like Smokey and the Bandit, like run the car off the road into the ditch, off the ledge, to destroy the ballots and the cartridges that contain the electronic information. It's hard to do. And you probably wouldn't be able to have a huge impact just because of all of the checks and balances that we have. There would be not a lot of gain for a really lot of effort in terms of rigging on election day. In California, again, I'm not speaking for places like Georgia, but here in California, I think it's safe to say that unless you're, 10 or 15 ballots off, you're probably gonna be okay when it comes to casting ballots on election day. Okay, but there is actually a different place. The Electoral College. So once we have once the state counts out the ballots, then they decide who the winner is, and then the electoral votes go to the federal government. And this is another sort of soft spot where if you wanted to rig an election, this would be the place to go. Now, let's start with the Constitution. The Constitution says we have to elect electors in the way designated by the state legislature. And the state legislature has been and is made up of members of political parties. So what did state legislatures do? They very immediately give the power to choose electors to political parties. So the way it works in, let me just back up one second. The Electoral College, a lot of people have a lot of different reasons for these. There's, people say, oh, it's too far to travel. Like, it's all kind of BS, like, ideas about why we have one. Let's not forget, like, the basic fundamental tenet here, which is, this is from George Mason at the Constitutional Convention. He said, it would be as unnatural to refer the choice of proper character for the chief magistrate, president, to the people as it would to refer the trial of colors to a blind man. The extent of the country renders it impossible that people can have the requisite capacity to judge the respective pretensions of the candidates. George Mason, pretension expert. Do not forget, like, and some of you this year might be looking around going, you know what? He's on to something. We don't totally disagree here at the Commonwealth Club with all my smarty pants audience members. Maybe this year is, you go, yeah, yay, Electoral College. So in California, for example, the way it works is by October of each year, each party submits their 55 electoral, their electors, basically. And so what happens is on election day, depending on who wins, and we have winner take all, and every state in America, except for Maine and Nebraska, every state in America has winner take all. And that just means whoever wins the popular vote gets all the electors. So you're voting for whomever. And that person who wins on election day, all 55 of those electors that they submitted get to go to the elector party. They get to, you know, go to the meeting. It's a meeting. Past electors are people like in 2012, Obama electors were Dolores Huerta. And locally, if you guys might remember or recognize the name Jane Morrison, of course, she was also an elector. So each party determines its own method for selecting electors. And this is really important because this is pretty much the only thing keeping people voting the way they're supposed to. Because if you think about it, if you picked 55 people and they weren't party regulars, they weren't people you could rely on as good Democrats or Republicans, they could potentially vote for whomever. They could vote for the Kardashians. You guys know I love a map. So here's my map. All right, for those of you in the back, if you look at the red states, red states are what we're going to call void states. Those are the airtight states where the link between the vote and the Electoral College vote is really good. Really good. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in a second. But then there's the purple pledge states. That's states where you have to say a pledge. I pledge to do what the voters tell me to do. Then we have the shall states. California is a shall state. And then we have the GOP and Democrat. And I want you to understand the gray and the white are states where there are no rules. No rules. So let's think about this. The party gets to pick, and there are no rules about how you vote as an elector. No legal rules, let's say that. No legal rules, but how you vote as an elector versus the Electoral College. Texas. So we think about a state with a lot of Electoral College votes who maybe doesn't want to cast their Electoral College votes for Donald Trump. Maybe they'd rather cast them for literally anyone else. Ted Cruz. Oh, whoa, sir, in the front. This map is trying to explain that we do not have a uniform rule about how we connect the vote to the actual act of the electors. Because remember, the popular vote does not matter. There is no federal agency that even collects the popular vote. That's some stuff that like media organizations do. The federal government collects the Electoral College votes. That is it. That is it. They're done. So I'll give you an example of the void states. So remember, so the red states, those four, in those states, well, let me back up. Think about this. If someone came to you and said, all right, you guys might remember this when you were little, back when parents would leave their kids alone. I know, weird. When my parents would leave, they would go out to like dinner with their friends, and they'd be like, you guys be in bed by 10. You'd be like, hey. Or what, right? You shall be in bed by 10. Okay, no worries. That's the dilemma of passing laws when it comes to the Electoral College, because by the time the thing has happened, it has already happened. And the reason the void states are so important is because they stop it at the beginning. They don't say, hey, go to bed by 10. They say, if you're not in bed by 10, someone's going to jump out of the closet and bonk you on the head and put you to sleep at 10. Like they build in the remedy right there. So for example, what they say, this is an example from Utah. They say basically if an elector casts a vote that is contrary to the popular vote, their vote is void. It is considered a resignation of your job as an elector, and they record a better good vote for the vote that is reflective of the popular vote. So those four states, they basically say, if you even try, we're going to on the front end, like, prevent you. All right. The pledge states are adorable. They say, the pledge states say, a person, electors have to take an oath. I hereby promise that I will be in bed by 10. No worries. But there's no repercussions. And even if there were, it's kind of, the deal is done. When your parents get home and they say, oh, well, you were up till 2. Well, you've already been up at 10, right? The damage is done. The electoral votes have been cast and counted, right? So these pledge states, again, remember, this is purple. In these states, you just have to take a pledge, and there doesn't appear to be a ton of enforcement. And then in the shall states, California is a shall state, so we use California's statute here. California says electors shall vote for that person. You shall be in bed by 10, young lady. But again, no repercussions. And again, even if there were, it's after the fact. So to bring it back, we have a map of, aside from the red, a lot of issues with the Electoral College and whether or not they have to vote the way that the popular vote goes. Now, have people done this before in history? Yes, they're called faithless electors, and we've had it happen almost 200 times in history. But it has never swung a presidential election. Usually it's like some sort of protest vote, right? Because you know your guy's going to totally win. You know Nixon's going to totally win, so I'm going to cast my vote for Goldwater because I can. But in this year, depending on how crazy people want to be, this is a way where you could actually have an impact on the vote. I will leave you with this, and we can start the rest of it. And I know this is a little wordy, so I'm sorry for the people in the back, and I won't read the whole thing to you. But remember, people have been trying to reform the Electoral College basically since it was passed. So this is from a Senate committee from 1826. They immediately started trying to reform the Constitution. And they basically say, after the first time we did this Electoral College thing, the electors, dang it, started promising that they were going to vote the way the voters wanted them to. And that stinks. That's not what we asked for. They say, electors, they're not independent or in superior characters, which they were intended to be. Superior characters. They were intended to be. They're not left to the exercise of their own judgment. On the contrary, they give their vote or bind themselves to give it according to the will of their constituents. They have denigrated into mere agents in a case which requires no agency. And where the agent must be useless if he is faithful, and dangerous if he is not. This year's danger is here. And look, no one wants any kind of sort of constitutional crisis. But if there's anything to be worried about in terms of rigging an election, it's not about what's happening on election day. It's about what happens after. Anyway, thanks.
So you're all ready to commit some electoral fraud now?
Yeah.
Thank you, Melissa.
Yeah.
Welcome to Week to Week. This is the political roundtable of the Commonwealth Club of California. It's also your group therapy session for the 2016 election. This is Monday, August 22nd, 2016. This week, we learned that Donald Trump's campaign, its Colorado office in the Denver area, is being run, this is true, by a 12-year-old. For real, it's an actual 12-year-old by the name of Weston Eimer. We also heard today that Donald Trump is getting foreign policy advice from Michelle Bachmann. So write your own joke. I just put those two unrelated items out there. Thanks for joining us here in San Francisco. I'm John Zipperer, your host for the program. And today we're, of course, going to talk about more of the presidential election. We're also going to talk about some California politics. The economy's role in this campaign, as well as a kind of a grab bag of other political issues that are in the news. As always, I note that the Commonwealth Club represents people of a wide variety of views, so any opinions that are expressed here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Let's meet our panelists for today. Starting on the far end is Carson Bruno. He's a Hoover Institution Research Fellow. He's on Twitter at CarsonJFBruno. Next to him, you've already met, of course, Melissa Kane, a political analyst at CBS San Francisco. She's She's on Twitter at MelissaCain1. And Dr. James Taylor, Director of African American Studies and a Professor of Political Science at the University of San Francisco. And I've been ribbing him for not being on Twitter. It turns out he is on Twitter. So you can find him at Ootie. That's OOTTIE.
That's right. That's my family name. That's what it is, inside family name.
There are question cards throughout the room, of course. Write down some questions. We'll pick them up, and I'll try to ask as many of them as possible during the program. On to today's program, onto the roundtable part. Let's start with the presidential election. Let's start with, what would you call it, Donald Trump's relaunch, his rebranding, his recalibration, his firing a bunch of his staff. Carson, what do you make about what Donald Trump's done over the past week and a half?
It was necessary. Something had to happen. Mm-hmm. But what that something was up for debate amongst a lot of people, depending on kind of who you talk to and who you support or don't support. But something had to happen, especially after the Manafort Ukrainian dealings came out, where he was apparently shoveling money around the barriers that we have for lobbying in D.C. to try to get pro-Russian Ukrainian lobbyists into D.C. to try to change kind of our foreign policy.
Now, was that the where he was linked to possibly $12 million off the books?
Yeah. So after that, you know, it's kind of hard not to do something. I mean, I think Trump knew that. And this is a guy who doesn't really have many political instincts. Something had to happen. Now the question is, was what happened the right move? Now some in the kind of the alt-right, the alternative right movement, the Breitbarts of the world are, you know, cheerleading the fact that Steve Bannon and is now the campaign chairman, or I forget what title he actually has.
CEO.
Yeah, this is also a thing. At one point, there was a campaign chairman, a CEO, and a campaign manager. Now, tell me who's in charge in that situation, including then the candidate himself. So who's in charge? That's a whole different can of beans. So something had to happen. Now, of course, the alt-right is thrilled because their man is now kind of leading the charge. They have their candidates. They've kind of taken over the party in many, many cases. Is it going to really change anything? Probably not. It seems like they're going to double down on what they've been doing, which some people are arguing, you know what, that's all he can really do. So you might as well just kind of continue doing what you've been doing. It got him this far. You know, what's the worst that could happen?
Do you feel like this feeds in, especially the Breitbart connection, feeds into the idea that he's got this agenda that's either in lieu of or in addition to a presidential agenda of creating a media company or platform for himself and for his beliefs as well?
This is the rumor that Donald Trump is really starting a Donald Trump cable channel.
Right. Here's the one thing. Donald Trump's biggest weakness from day one when he rode down that escalator is the fact that he has absolutely zero humility. Zero. And he's made this entire campaign about himself, for good or for worse. Again, depending on who you talk to, his supporters think it's great. Everyone else in the world thinks it's terrible. But it's always been about himself. And so, no, I think he's gonna do something after he loses the election. And why not try to milk this for all it's worth at the end of the day? And it's very possible he kind of becomes a kind of an alternative to the Fox News kind of conservative news network.
I was going to ask this as a news quiz question, but don't worry, I have extras. Saw today that his family has earned $7.5 million extra so far during this campaign because the campaign is using Trump businesses. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a new meaning to the idea of a self-funded campaign. Yeah. I mean, it's a internally perpetual motion.
It starts, and I love to get Melissa's opinion, especially from the legal standpoint, because it begs the question, you know, is this stuff legal? Is it allowed?
We've never seen this before, actually. You've never had a candidate who also owns the hotel in which they're holding meetings that they're paying with out of their campaign coffers. We've just never had one, certainly not at this level. So the answer is yes, it seems to be legal for now, though you know, it may require some closing of a loophole that really no one realized was there because no one's ever, again, we've never seen one that like owns the golf course that they're taking people. Like Trump Ice was the one, was one of the vendors. Trump Ice.
And I think people forget, this is the third time. This is actually the third time that Trump has won a run. And this is the second time he actually said he turned a profit in running for the office. And so for him, this is an important leap forward in terms of a business venture, as well as, you know, the accidental happening of perhaps being elected. But he clearly was focused.
And do you think it would be a disappointment then if he got elected?
Because I've said this before locally that, you know, that office, and when you sort of look at the requirements of the office and the limits of the office is very limited by checks and balances, separation of powers. In fact, the most important book on presidential power in American political science history is written by Richard Neustadt. And he basically says that the only power that the United States president really has is the power of personal persuasion. Not the power of the office, not the power of the stick, but the power to persuade 100 other equals in the Senate and 435 other people in the House that they have to agree, and there's a common ground that they can make and, you know, meet at where they can further legislation in common. But for Donald Trump to think, and this happened to Truman, and this happened to Kennedy, and this happened to Obama. With Truman, he was shocked that people, when he said jump, didn't say how high, Mr. President. Kennedy, you remember with the Khrushchev missile crisis, it was exposed that we ended up having missiles 90 miles away from Russia over in Turkey. And Kennedy had ordered them removed already, and he was shocked that they weren't removed. And Obama came into that office, assuming that with his charisma, he would be able to change the world all over again. And Obama, you know, ended up the shortest presidency. I argue that Barack Obama had a 2-year presidency. Basically, after the Tea Party revival or emergence in 2010, the effective presidency of Barack Obama was over, in terms of real governance and policy.
And that's been a recurring complaint of other presidents.
Yes.
I mean, George W. Bush has said that, too. It's like you get in there, and it's not like when you press a button, something happens.
So Trump's ego is at verse with the requirements and the limits of the office itself.
It's almost like he doesn't know much about it.
He does not. He sees from afar. He projects it as a historical, I think, opportunity. But I don't think he understands what the boredom of the office is. Like people that are so eager in undergraduate and out of high school, I want to go to law school because I can talk real good. And then they find out it's more about good thinking and good writing. And it's really tedious. And
did I meet you in high
school? And it's not all, you know, L.A. law in the courtroom litigating, tearing it down. It's a whole different reality.
Right.
I think Trump has to face that.
And it brings up a good point. I mean, he just doesn't know. He doesn't not know what the office is about. He doesn't understand what campaigning is about, too. If you look at the most recent July the fundraising numbers and expenditure numbers of the two campaigns, the top three biggest expenditure items for Trump and Clinton. So Trump is first. Digital consulting and online advertising at 44%. Then air travel, 15%. So we go from 44 to 15% for the top three biggest items for him. And then merchandise at 9%. Those are the top three items where he spent money on in the month of July. Clinton, on the other hand, goes media buys for 66% of her July expenditures. Then the payroll benefits, payroll taxes at 12%, and travel at 6%. Clinton is trying to win an election. I don't know what Trump's doing.
Trump is winning in a Charlie. Trump is winning in a Charlie Sheen kind of way. That's how I see him winning. You know, he thinks he's winning and it's not winning.
Right.
But he is. I mean, for someone who's spending so little on sort of ground troops, he is hanging with her in the polls. Like you would think, someone spending, you know, we've got one person who's got 800 employees and one person who's got 80. There would be a tenfold difference between how they are doing in the polls. And yet that's not what we're seeing. It's not translating whatever he's, and I'm not saying he's doing all the right things, but I'm saying, you know, she's doing things a sort of traditional way. He's doing it in a non-traditional way. He's hanging with her pretty good.
Nationally, yes.
But nationally. And look, even though he's down in a number of swing states, he's down single digits. And when you look, you know, add in the margin of error, it's not really that. She's not killing it in the way you might think a candidate would running like a machine like she's running versus his very sort of interesting experiment.
But the problem, I agree with you, but the problem I think Trump has when you look at many of these polls, he's in the 30s. And that's not good. I mean, if he's in the 40s, 42, 43, there's room for, you know, you might be able to close the gap. But when you're down in 36, 34%,
he hasn't broken out of that core.
Somebody doesn't like you if you're getting 30%. And of course, across the board, every major ethnic population in this country, outside of men, white men, do not like Trump and do not like him intensely.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I mean, what's keeping the numbers so tight, and I agree, they are tight. They've tightened by 3 points since Clinton's DNC like high post DNC peak. It's the fact that they're both really not liked. Now Trump is much more not liked, but Clinton still, she's underwater by 10 points in favorable poll or favorability also. So he has the benefit of running against the least liked Democrat ever, but she has the benefit of running against the least liked candidate ever. So it helps.
I think it's really interesting. It's phenomenal the way Hillary Clinton has become so unpopular in the last 3 years when she was the most popular woman on the planet from 1994 to 2013. Everyone's forgotten that Hillary Clinton was championed by Donald Trump voters when she was running against the black guy. Everybody, remember PUMA, Party Unity My A? Remember that? Those are the same Reagan Democrats that refused to support Obama that supported Hillary that are now mad at Hillary and supporting Trump. These people are confused. Yeah. And anybody who's relying on them to deliver Donald Trump because they're angry young people or angry middle-aged people, again, as a political scientist, you don't rely on powerless people or people who are dispossessed, unfortunately, and this is against my own politics, to actually mobilize politically because they're discouraged by their condition and their predicament. So many of these people who are crying and out for help in the form of Donald Trump's campaign, are in this unfortunate predicament.
And you are seeing a number of folks saying, win or lose, probably lose, Trumpism or the what he's surfaced, to use the common term, is going to be with us. So we'll have plenty of further conversations about this in the years to come. Someone actually writes and says, you're talking an awful lot about Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Hillary Clinton and her health. Is this a real, have you seen, well, Rudy Giuliani, you know, talking about her mental health and such. Is this all just campaign silliness, or
that's one of the things where I go back to this humility thing for the Trump campaign. They have so much that they could hit the Clintons in general as a couple and a family over, and Hillary herself on, that they are choosing her health or something like that as a, there's no way for you to ever really be sure what's going on there. I mean, there's doctor, you know, patient privilege. So if something is happening, then you have no clue of actually being able to prove or disprove it, really. So why focus on this conjecture when, especially when there's the Clinton Foundation stuff, the emails continue to be a point of contention, and so much other issues that you could really go after her about, but they're trying to make it, again, all about Trump, and Trump trumps everything at the end of the day, which kind of takes away from the fact that they're running against someone.
Well, someone else does ask about the Clinton Foundation, and do you ever see them actually shutting it down, considering the controversy? Should they consider that?
They absolutely should.
Why?
I just think it creates too many questions. The one thing as a politician you never want to do, and I've said this multiple times, I think, on the stage, is to reinforce the perceived caricature that you have in the public. The Clintons have a perceived, for better or worse, I mean, for right or wrong, that they're kind of shady. They're kind of doing something behind the scenes, not really being totally honest with you, just telling you kind of what they legally have to tell you. And that perception is there. I mean, it's been there for decades now, going back to when Bill was governor of Arkansas. So I understand why they're not doing it, because they definitely have a hubris about themselves also. They like being, you know, at the center of attention.
In their defense, they've also created a foundation that's raised billions of dollars,
which
only
10% has really been donated to charity. So I mean, it's been used as kind of a post-presidency thing. I mean, there are, again, arguments on both sides of whether the effectiveness of the foundation has actually been good. But at the end of the day, she's running for the most powerful office in the world. And you can't have any semblance of some sort of corruption happening at the center of that. And so they can always start something new, probably even better, after she wins the presidency, serves 8 years, and comes out. So why put up with all of this that could just be a distraction for the entire presidency of the first woman president.
Okay, well.
And, right. then making the adjustments and trying to react to the criticisms make them look bad, too.
Of
Bill Clinton stepping down, but not right away. Yeah. Well, why do you need to step down if there's nothing wrong with it in the first place? Why do you need to distance yourself and your family if it wasn't corrupt? Why are you now making these decisions to avoid the appearance of corruption if it wasn't corrupt from the outset?
I would put forth that they could close down the Clinton Foundation and something else would be put forward as being, you know, I mean, there's been a machine. I'm going to sound like a Clinton campaign person here, but there's been a machine going after her for decades.
Right.
And but she's serving it up. Like unassisted, with this email server thing, with this, with the foundation, you don't have to do this. And I'm not saying they shouldn't try to do good in the world, but you could raise money for another foundation. I'm surprised she didn't do this while she was Secretary of State. As soon as I'm running for president, you got to shut down the appearance of impropriety because you've been in the public in the eye for so. You've been in the arena, as they said at the convention. You know this is coming. Like. Get it together. Shut it down. You're never going to be able to convince people that you took money from this government and didn't do them favors. Shut it down. Show that you have some friends in your life who are not in politics, who are in your ear. I don't know about you guys. I got two brothers who will be like, you're an idiot. Like, they will tell, they're civilians. They will tell me when I'm doing something that looks bad. But the echo chamber that these guys are in is allowing them to, and maybe that's because they've, been so fancy for so long, but it's allowing them to do things that even Democrats are like, dang it, why did you do? What did you think secretarystate@gmail.com was going to lead to? Like, how did you think that was going to be like a cool thing? That was going to be fine when you run for president. Like, don't serve it up. And yes, there's teams of people digging for anything, but she's making it fairly easy at this point.
But I would say that in and of itself, even though Trump and the RNC can prosecute this, you have to remember Tony Rezko, right? Anybody remember Tony Rezko? See, you don't remember Tony Rezko. Some of you do, right? Remember Obama's housing deal where he bought this property in Chicago, with this weird money? Remember all of that? Most of us have forgotten about Tony Rezko already. I'm glad you don't remember, because that's what I think will happen to the Clinton Foundation issue at some point as it becomes subordinate to more pressing and still, I think, interesting issues that are going to emerge with these new 15,000 emails that have been ordered to be released before October, forget November, by a federal judge today.
Here's a fun question. How do you expect a Hillary Clinton presidency to be different from the Bill Clinton presidency? Obviously there was a lot of kind of lead-in thinking, oh, this is Clinton part two, but she is a different person. She has taken some different positions. It's a different time. Any thoughts on that?
So today, I'm sure you guys have read, is the 20th anniversary of the welfare reform that Bill Clinton signed into law. And he's acknowledged that there were some shortcomings with it. So is she. She's also acknowledged, and I think they both have some shortcomings with trade agreements like NAFTA and even Bill Clinton's moves on the Glass-Steagall Act. So I think, it's not necessarily that it'll be something dramatically different, but if you think of it as a more mature a presidency that learned, ideally, this is how a Clinton, person might sell it to you. Somebody like a Bill Clinton, but one who's learned from what happened in, during his presidency, has seen the after effects and can sort of course correct accordingly. But dramatically, no, probably not.
I think it depends a lot on the Congress that she has. Particularly initially, but also after the midterms.
Those 2 years.
Those 2 years, especially, If Republicans can hold on and save the Senate and keep the House is definitely easier for them to retain, then her presidency starts off a lot different than I think that she would probably want it to, and especially the Democrats would want it to, and the Bernie Sanders fans would want her to. Now, if she has the Senate, and it's razor thin margins in the House, I think you see a completely different presidency at the onset. And those things will affect kind of how the midterms happen in 2018. Definitely, that then determines again kind of what does a triangulation need to happen and shift one way or the other. So a lot for her really depends on what happens down ballot. a lot more so than Trump for many reasons. But the Republicans, kind of what they do down ballot is really, really important.
I would just add that I think political context or political milieu has a great deal to do with shaping presidencies, independent of whether these two people were married. Let's just make Hillary not Bill's wife for now, and just as an emergent political person and candidate, and say, how does Hillary Clinton, you know, as a potential president, compare to previous presidents like Obama or previous Democrats like Bill Clinton? I think if you look at Bill Clinton's context, it was the economy, stupid, right? In 1991, 92. You had urban unrest in Los Angeles that exploded intensely, and it was that incident in L.A. 92 that I think had a great deal to do with impacting why George Bush came back from Gulf War at the 90%+ approval rating in February and was voted out of office by the electorate that following November, which is unheard of, winning a war and being elected out of office.
Yeah.
But that happened to Bush because of the economy and some of the issues, the political unrest, the sense of America balkanizing and the polarization, the sense of polarization that we had then, we have now. And I think these things will influence Hillary. And real quickly, what's really interesting is Hillary and Bill Clinton, especially Bill Clinton's policies, welfare reform, the mass incarceration, expanding police officers who are the command officers of the black, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement is marching against. The 300,000 police officers that Bill Clinton put on the office are now their command 20 years later. And so I think, and I've argued this on black radio, where the black audience responded to me and told me I was foolish for suggesting that blacks vote for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump, because they have her where they need her to be politically, because she owes them because of these offenses and these harms, and that have policy impacts on the African-American community. Who better to have listening to you now than Hillary Clinton? Hillary Clinton took and co-opted Bernie Sanders' Black Lives Matter agenda as much as she could. She had those mothers from the Black Lives Matter movement, Sandra Bland and all of the other mothers, come and speak. She had more officers of the law present and speaking at her convention in the RNC, et cetera. So I think there's, you know, there's something here where Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton have a lot of repenting to do with Black America. And if there's any politician that Black Americans can move because of what they have done to them in through policy, it's Bill and Hillary Clinton. So Black Americans, from the standpoint of political science, have precisely Hillary Clinton who they need to move her to make up for the harms that they have done against the black community since 1991, 92. What? From Ricky Ray Rector to Sister Soldier to these games they play with this strategy. Look this up and Google it. This strategy known as symbolic distance. It's the strategy Bill Clinton used in 1990 with black Americans. Go to Jesse Jackson's Operation Push event. Put your finger in Jesse's face to show white America you're not a McGovern or a Humphrey liberal and DNC Democrat. See, and that's what we're talking about. Donald Trump doing this now, talking to white audiences about black situations. Bill Clinton is the father of this thing. He's the architect of talking down to black America with white audiences and expecting a positive return. And of course, sadly, black people like Toni Morrison bought into this and embraced and donned Bill Clinton as the first black president, unfortunately.
One of the, I was going to, of course, ask about Donald Trump's.
Thank you.
I was going to ask about Donald Trump's that whole thing, his speech, his telling African-American audiences,
In the 80s, we used to say, and in the 90s, we used to say crack is whack. And Donald Trump talking to black Americans about anything other than, like Hillary, I'm sorry for what I've done, is the only conversation he could possibly have.
Well, but really right along to your point, this morning on National Public Radio, as I was coming into work, they were basically making the point of, he's really not talking to black audiences.
Yeah, yeah.
He's talking to suburban white Republicans who don't really, who don't feel comfortable with his more inflammatory language.
Yeah.
So he's basically talking to them saying, I'm not, going to be totally whack out.
Yeah. There's a right of center conservatism in America, generally. I mean, we might be moving in a different direction. But I think that, Donald Trump understands that the silent majority of Richard Nixon definitely agrees on law and order issues in general. And that's why Trump, along with all these other acts of desperation that we're seeing in terms of the Breitbart and the Roger Ailes pivot, is this pivot suddenly to talk to people that have told you Historically, they despise you. Donald Trump is known for 40 years, especially a New Yorker like me, a black New Yorker. We knew as a teenager, Donald Trump haunted people like me. When he took out a full page ad in the New York Times, the Daily News, and Newsday, and called for the death penalty of those five young men who gave up a combination of 100 years of their lives for Donald Trump. And Donald Trump was the Tribune and the champion. He and Rudy Giuliani. Let me explain this to you. The last thing, all Donald Trump needed to do to turn black America off was have Rudy Giuliani introduce him. After that, the conversation was over, and everything coming out of Donald Trump's mouth is wah, 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 wah. Because black America saw Rudy Giuliani, who locally, at the local level of New York politics, he and Trump were a part of a lynch mob. Do you hear me? Giuliani and Trump were a lynch mob against those five young boys, those teenagers in New York City who were innocent of their crimes, and none of them have apologized for what they did to these young men.
We're talking about the so-called Central Park jogger case, right?
Yes. And so this game of people asking me, like last night on Facebook, a friend asked me, what has Donald Trump done to be racist? I'm like, if I have to explain that to you, I can't. If I have to tell you in this room that where and how Donald Trump is a racist, I cannot tell you because you would never understand it. And so to me at this point, it's something that I think Trump is going to have to deal with. Let me say this real quickly and I'll shut up, is the Asian population. You know, what no one's really talking about is how Asian voters are watching what's happening with Trump. And the numbers I have more here, I won't go over them in detail, but Asians are enrolling. Their numbers have doubled from 2 million to 4 million voters over 12 to 16. They are overwhelmingly moving toward the Democratic Party. Continental Asians, Indians, Koreans, Japanese, Chinese, Vietnamese, all of them in the high 70s approval of Obama and in the high 70s of disapproval of Donald Trump, in the high 60s of approval of Hillary Clinton, across the board in every possible category. And what Donald Trump and the Republicans fail to understand is that when you offend other racial minorities, the Asian population doesn't say much of anything, but they interpret these signals as anti-Asian and anti-immigrant as well. And the largest group of Muslims in the world are not Arabs. They make up about 6% of the world's Muslims. The majority of the world's Muslims are Asians and Indians. Yeah. Indian yeah. Asians. Yeah. And so he's sitting around here offending, thinking he offended Arabs. And all the while, he's sitting here offending people that are going to have an impact on Hawaii, New York, and California voting. So when you say immigration is bad or, you know, build that wall, the Asian voters are saying, okay, Trump, we're going to build a wall, all right, around Trump Tower and put you back in it.
Well, we're going to move on to our next topic, and that is actually to bring it a bit more locally to California. There's a number of things I want to talk about in California politics, but I wanted to kind of jump off on, you know, something we see on the news every day, which is the latest reports on the wildfires and Governor Brown tying this to, you know, his climate change initiatives. He's had some problems getting some of that stuff through. I want to start with Carson. Give the governor a grade on how he's handling, let's start with the climate change, you know, the wildfires.
This has not been a good year for him, which is odd, given the fact that he is such a skilled politician, yeah. Skilled statesman, has amazing approval numbers. I mean, any governor would, you know, kill for the numbers that he keeps on posting. And the legislature is still eh. I mean, like, no one really likes the legislature. So the fact that he isn't really kind of getting his agenda smoothly pushed through is quite amazing, especially given the fact that he has something like $20 million in a bank account for ballot initiatives that he could spend anywhere he really wants to. There's a great article that came out today, I think it was in the San Jose Mercury, about how, like, these ballot initiative campaign accounts are kind of fudgeable. You know, politicians use them not really for the ballot initiative, supporting or opposing it. So Jerry Brown has a lot of leverage with that money. He doesn't have to spend it for opposing or supporting a ballot measure on the ballot. So let's kind of pull back. Kind of what's happening? I mean, as I was just on my way up here today, I saw AB 197. Probably means nothing to most people in the state. It is a kind of a random piece of legislation that would essentially create oversight over the California Air Resources Board, plus also some other things related to kind of the climate change actions, the cap and trade stuff happening in California. It was, last time I checked, it was on call in the state Senate, which means that it's not, it's just under the number of votes. They're trying to, like, the Democrats are trying to get a few kind of remaining people who haven't voted yet to vote yes or no. For them, hopefully yes. Why this is important, this random piece of legislation is important, is because it's linked currently, as written, to SB 32, which is kind of the next generation of AB 32, which created cap and trade in California. If SB 32 or AB 197, if either of them don't pass, the other one can't go into effect. Now, of course, it can be either one could be amended later on the floor, but it's highly unlikely. So the fact that AB 197 is on call right now, or at least it was a few hours ago, suggests that there's still a lot of hesitancy within the state legislature on these major climate change issues, which is quite surprising given the fact that the Democrats control the majority, very aggressively control the majority. I mean, they're just one seat away from a supermajority in the Senate, three seats away in the Assembly. So, I mean, they have a lot of votes at their disposal. So this isn't like Republicans are being evil here. Yes, they're all voting no on it. But a lot of Democrats aren't voting yes on it either. They're abstaining, most of them, instead of voting no. So this is a huge setback because Governor Brown has made climate change a massive component of his, Jerry Brown 2.0
Does he have any other agenda at this point?
No.
It seems like that's all
he talks about.
And I'm not saying it's – I mean, look, it's important, obviously. But I mean, aren't there –
That's the kicker, too. There are some serious problems in this state. Roads being the first, bridges, all of our crumbling infrastructure, which was the pride and joy of his father. Right. We have massive water problems. Yes, the drought has subsided, but we're still in a drought, FYI. I mean, so don't go like turning on your faucets and leaving the house. We're still in a drought. Yet nothing has really been done on that matter. They've passed this, they've done with this, 25% mandate cuts, but it's not doing anything really to impact the drought. We have unfunded pension liabilities that are ballooning out of control. We have, name it. We have so many poverty. We have housing affordability. I mean, it's crazy that there's so much time spent. There were over 5,000 bills introduced in the 2015-2016 legislative session. 5,000 bills. Bills, constitutional amendments, and resolutions. How many of those actually try to tackle any of the major long-term systemic problems facing the state? If I had to guess, probably a few hundred, if that. I mean, and those things were kind of around the edges sort of fixes. They weren't really true systemic fundamental changes, reforms to the problems that we're facing, that our children will be facing, that my generation will be facing, that my children's generation will be facing. And it's just kind of like they're patting themselves on the back because they did this or they did that. They passed this resolution. Whoop-de-doo.
Well, and if a governor with as high approval ratings and, frankly, as much persuasive and bully pulpit power,
right,
as Jerry Brown can't tackle some of those really big things, is Gavin Newsom or whoever else might succeed him going to be any more successful?
Exactly. That's the big question. The big question is, I think for Democrats in general, can they get to the supermajority in the state legislature after this coming election? Very probable. And do they just kind of wait to kind of tackle these issues the way that they want to with basically a veto without being able to be vetoed by the next governor or Jerry Brown, without having to ask the Republicans for a single vote or two votes here or there. So that's the big question. I think the biggest disappointment of this legislative session, in my opinion, was, and this just happened this week, is the fact that Governor Brown's by right reforms are dead in the water.
Okay, and you might need to explain briefly what that means.
By right is delicious, by the way.
By right.
I don't know what you're so mad about.
By right is like the holy grail when it comes to housing affordability, and something that keeps on holding California back. Essentially, what by right is any development that meets the current land use zoning ordinances that are on the books, if it meets those, complies with those, then goes immediately to administrative review and gets permitting, kind of the proposal goes through the process. California is one of very few states that doesn't have by right just as the default. So regardless of the land use zoning ordinances that are in any locality, every single proposal has to not only get administratively reviewed, but also politically legislative reviewed. So either by the whole host of commissions that might be dealing with the proposal, and then also the city council board of supervisors. It creates multiple pockets of opposition that basically mucks up the whole development process, delays the whole process, and then is truly actually designed to kill development at the end of the day.
Institutionalized NIMBYism.
Exactly, exactly.
Now, his proposal was that there are some exceptions, but basically if a multifamily development met those conditions and had, I think, at least 20% affordable housing,
yeah,
however that's defined locally, it would qualify for this streamlining, yeah, I guess, of the process. And it was voted, or was it actually voted on?
It never made it to the floor, never made it to a committee because of opposition amongst environmentalists who are concerned about the CEQA exemption that would be kind of attached to it. And actually, environmentalists don't like the infill development either for some reason that is really beyond me, to be honest, because it's actually the way to really reduce carbon emissions.
Yeah, if it's not built in there, it's going to be built, yeah, out in a suburb.
And then also labor unions didn't like it also.
Carson, you are on record as being very anti-initiative.
Yes.
Like voter initiative. Would this kind of thing, this kind of CEQA reform, this kind of affordable housing tied to CEQA reform as by right, would that be the kind of thing that would need to be on the ballot since it's clear that it offends so many entrenched interests in Sacramento? Because I think if you put something like that on the, yeah, ballot, like where you could sail through if you're building affordable housing, people are like, yes, you know, like this is, it would be a fairly popular thing. Would you be willing to bend your rule just a little?
You're being recorded.
It depends on how the initiative is worded. No, at the end of the day, most initiatives are not well thought out plans. So that's why I always have a big problem with them. This is an idea, a reform that warrants probably something of the initiative, where the initiative could be very useful. But at the end of the day, it really depends on kind of how the proposal is worded.
I look forward to your draft.
But the thing here is, and this is one of the biggest problems I think that is facing California particularly, but housing all across the country. It's this concept of local control. Localities across the country are the ones who determine zoning, development, anything. And the fact that they just don't like the idea of the state coming in or even a regional board coming in and kind of telling them what they can and cannot do with what they consider their land. It's an anomaly to, I think, the United States in many respects, but it's even more so anomaly to California. Our friends up, you know, north of us in Washington State, they have statewide kind of appeal boards. Massachusetts also has an appeal board where if you don't like what your locality is doing, you can appeal up to the state level, and then they can force the locality to do something. It kind of goes to this level. Again, I'm a policy analyst. You know, you want the level of government determining the policy that's going to most effectively and efficiently implement it or pass it. You would never think to kind of do national security at the local level because that just makes no sense. San Francisco is going to have its own little army, and so is Atherton and Belmont and Hillsborough.
Some would say San Francisco and Berkeley think they have their own,
yes,
foreign policy.
but no one thinks that's a rational way to do national security. It's the history of housing, especially in California, especially in the coastal part of California, has proven that localities just cannot implement land use and zoning rules efficiently and effectively for the greater good of the entire society, both the current residents and future residents.
And when it comes to affordable housing, federal government has largely washed its hands,
yes,
of anything. They enable it through shallow subsidies of like tax credits and things like that, but they're not out there financing and building things.
And of course, this week here in San Francisco, HUD just rejected the supervisors' plan to try to thwart the outflow of African Americans and other groups, especially senior citizens, out of the city. And there, the irony is it was the black movement that created, you know, that led to the CCA Fair Housing Act that has run up against the attempt to thwart the outflow of blacks. So it's like segregation laws limited their access to opportunities in terms of housing, and then these laws were created to prevent this kind of discrimination, and then it's almost like affirmative action. It ends up being used against a group that mobilized to get this policy in their behalf, and it got turned back on them and been used to the advantage of others.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the unfortunate thing.
Well, and as far as the state being an enabler, a creator of, I mean, affordable housing, Governor Brown made it really clear back in June. He sees it as a waste of money. I mean, he pretty much said as much to the Los Angeles Times that, you know, it's a waste. This is a supply and demand problem, which...
And Willie Brown's on the record, too, with the same position.
Oh, is
Willie Brown here in San Francisco has the same attitude of inevitability, that there's a new majority and it would be constituted of Asian, American, you know, San Franciscans,
yeah.
Whites,
others. I know someone who has actually started two different affordable housing nonprofits,
right.
And used to publish the Affordable Housing Magazine. He was my boss, so take that into consideration. But he was always a fan of Willie Brown because Willie Brown pushed through a number of affordable housing.
Sure.
Projects here, and he was always saying, "Look," and really, what he was doing was going over the local complaints and saying, "We're going to do this." And
so, for affordable housing, you know,
yeah.
that's not a controversy with Willie Brown. I think it is the question of whether or not there should be artificial attempts to try to stave the outflow of people moving out. That's what he took issue with, and feels like, and he's on record for years of saying, "Look, this is just the way it is. Just let it be."
But the biggest problem, especially for the Bay Area, is this isn't a new problem. It's something that the localities up and down the peninsula, on the East Bay, in Marin County, have been delinquent on building housing for decades. And so now it's become this issue that's really kind of popped in their faces, and the affordability issue is so severe that they're trying to scramble, if at all, to do something, and there's not enough for them to actually be able to do. It's really hard to speed up projects. I mean, even if, you know, I live in the city of Mountain View, even if the city of Mountain View were to approve 10,000 new units of any kind, affordable, not affordable, you're still looking at, you know, a year at best, probably 2 to 3 years of those units hitting the market. That's not going to really help the situation now. So from a political standpoint, these local elected officials want something immediate, but unfortunately, there's nothing immediate that can actually happen for them. This is something that their predecessors really have kind of screwed them over with, but it needs to happen.
Well, yeah, just back at the local level in San Francisco, I don't know if any of you have seen today's Examiner, but it has this question and this issue of are rents, you know, dropping in San Francisco, and it's sort of a mixed response that in some places they are, where they highlight a case of a couple who got an $1,800 studio with a kitchen and you know, other amenities,
yeah.
I think, in SoMa. So that was a big deal for them. And this is, I guess, you know, the beginning of a trend of lower rents.
There's certainly, because I heard some comments when you were talking about, you know, actual building, there hasn't been enough. And I think people in San Francisco are kind of thinking, wait a minute, I'm seeing all of these big, you know, you drive up Market, especially near Castro, every corner you turn around, there's a whole other new one. Those have finally, from at least my reporting, have started to have a small impact on the high end, right? Because a lot of these were market rate and even luxury condos. So pricing has started to be affected. The thing is, the numbers of how many, I think the city analyst or comptroller, I don't know the exact title, he said we're basically 100,000 units short of what we would need before the supply and demand really kicked in and we could be, you know, people can start talking about affordable stuff. I'm going to put you all to sleep with my housing stuff, so I'll move along. Let's try to get in a few short things before we get to the news quiz.
Try to get Melissa in here.
I've talked enough.
Naked Trump statues. Did anyone here actually go and see the one in Castro? Two people. What did you think? Was this? We actually did the question out there on this. Was this inappropriate? Was it fair game? What are your thoughts? Melissa?
I didn't think it was cool. Honestly, you know, if it was a Hillary Clinton statue,
right.
I think people would be up in arms. I think it was kind of mean in a way that is the kind of thing people say they don't like about Donald Trump. Do you know what I mean? It's, you know, Michelle Obama said, when they go low, we go high. You know what I mean? Like, I felt like if you don't like Donald Trump, you know, go high. And it felt like it was going low. And I, you know, and it had smacked of body shaming and aging issues that I didn't think was appropriate
and of course,
at all.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. The sexism implicit in him, you know, having a very, you know, invisible, you know, organ, et cetera. I'm trying to be as PG as I can. Also was offensive in the implication that, you know, if you don't have any, you know, cojones, you therefore are not strong, which offends women in many ways.
It,
you know?
It was intended
so
to,
that was also a colleague of mine who does gender and sexuality studies at USF wrote a piece, and she basically talked about the way in which this is doing the very thing that we despise in terms of, you know, shaming of people's bodies, et cetera. And how are you any better than Donald Trump if you put him out piggishly in the way in which he's put other groups and people out piggishly?
And frankly, you know, every day he gives liberals a reason to be mad at him. Like, we don't need to make things up, right? We don't need to, like, invent ways to make fun of him. You know, like, there's plenty of non-physical reasons and ways that that Democrats can, you know, can take aim at Trump without going there.
So Never Trump isn't the one that put those out there. It was it was actually an anarchist group, I think.
Oh, right.
So,
and what were they? What was that? What did they accomplish?
I think by having that categorization of themselves, they don't have to explain.
But you also see a lot of like online depictions of Trump with without a hairpiece.
Oh, sure.
To try to show him as not nearly as we all have gotten used to seeing him, to sort of show what's really going on under there, to see Trump in a more, a less authoritative, less powerful way.
I thought
way
I was trying to point out the incredible power and beauty of bald people.
Hey, you have no problem with it.
That's another interpretation.
I'm all for it, but of course, they were trying to make him look bad.
Briefly, actually, kind of something, we touched on the economy. Remember 1992, it's the economy, stupid. How big is that the driving force in the elections, where, you know, this year? Any thoughts on that? I mean, is it the overwhelming thing, or things are kind of running along smoothly, so people are voting on some of these issues of, you know, you mentioned kind of the sense of falling apart and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think different parts of the electorate are interested in different things. When I was talking about Asians in general, there's also a breakdown by age and gender.
Sure.
And young people, 18 to 34, amongst Asians in general, supported Barack Obama in the high 80s.
Really?
And yet Asians, Asians of all cohorts, it drops down to about 60%. So, you know, you have things going on, I think, in the subtext of the larger questions and issues.
Melissa, what do you think?
I think the economy, and because I think, look, if you look at sort of the three biggest issues, the economy, immigration, and national security, you know, immigration is tied into the economy, right? So much of that is related to the idea that the reason wages are kept artificially low is because you've got people working off the books, things like that. I think those two anxieties go together. I think, you know, it's one of these things where I'm like, when was it ever not the economy? I would really like to have lived then. my whole life, it's always been the economy. But I think it is this year, and I think you see that in the ancillary subjects that are catching on as well, because I think for people, look, they're for some people, immigration has a different issue, you know, has other, you know, sort of more race-based or color-based or ethnicity-based issues. But for a lot of folks, it really is an economic one. Yeah. And so they sort of tie together.
Carson?
Yeah, Melissa, I mean, hit it on the nose. And James brought up something earlier about the Clinton presidency being kind of the economy. The next Clinton presidency is going to have the economy, but I think in a very different way than Bill had. I mean, we are now in the 87th or going into the 87th month of the expansion from the Great Recession. The average post-World War II expansion has been 58 months. So, you know, for, again, better or worse, for, you know, no one's really at fault, but business cycles ebb and flow. We are right now in one of the longest expansions. It's been tepid for a lot of people, but still it's an expansion nonetheless. And it's going to reverse at some point. And how big it's going to reverse is, you know, again, up for debate. But whoever's president next is most likely going to have a recession of some sort under their presidency, and they're going to have to deal with it.
And there's something called the misery index that political scientists look at, which is a sort of measuring of the inflation rate and the unemployment rate during an election cycle. And the extent to which those things are coupled and people actually feel them and feel miserable around the time of election tends to affect them to either go motivates them to go vote, or motivates them or discourages them from voting altogether. So right now, with Barack Obama reaching Ronald Reagan, Ike Eisenhower's second term, numbers of approval. I mean, the conservatives don't realize that Barack Obama has been a lame duck for over a year, and they continue to act like this man still has power. They're going to miss him when he's gone. Because they actually still treat Obama like he still has power. It's like, no, this guy is on his way out. He's going to China. He's going to Cuba. He's chilling.
You know something? Yeah. I watch him. I think he looks like he's enjoying his job.
Yes.
For the first time.
Because he's done. How many of you have been done with your job and like, yes, I'm done, right? Right?
So. Well, listen, panelists, thank you for a spirited program. Let's do our news quiz. If Colette, our prize distributor, could come up and get the mysterious prizes, it's chocolate. Okay, I'm going to read a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. And if you're right, Colette will deliver unto you some chocolate. If you're wrong, you can try again. But if you do win, let someone else win the next one. So the first question, did you see the story? According to Condé Nast Traveler magazine, what is the friendliest city in the world? It's not San Francisco. I saw your hand first, sir.
Charleston, South Carolina.
Very good.
Really?
You people read the news.
Friendly for who? That's with a Confederate flag where they're shooting black people and nine in the building? Who's that? Is that
okay, James,
Donald Trump?
James.
Friendly for Donald Trump, maybe. Okay, I'll stop.
If you answer every one of his questions, you get chocolate.
My mother's from South Carolina. That shocked me.
Okay. What would be a safe question to ask?
Who's the next black president?
A Spanish publisher has won the rights to make a copy, to produce multiple copies of a certain book that no one has been able to read. What's the name of this book? It's a something manuscript. Anyone? Have you seen this story? Very good. The Voynich Manuscript. It's written in a code or a language no one can understand. It's a couple centuries old, and they're going to produce new copies. And I can.
It's going to be a bestseller.
Yes. Okay.
I love it. Good for you.
Some French towns, some towns in France, are banning what at their beaches? Sir, I saw your hand shoot up first. Burkinis. That is correct.
Oh.
Burkinis. They're full body. Burka swimsuits. A 12-year-old suicide bomber killed 54 people at what? Ma'am, along the end there. A wedding in Turkey, a Kurdish wedding. Let's see. Angered by criticism of his war on drugs, the Philippines president has threatened to leave what? Ma'am. The United Nations, that is correct. That's a boring question there. Let's skip to one. Okay, here's one. San Francisco's protocol chief, her name is Charlotte Schultz. She's a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. But as part of her duties for the city, she helped unveil a statue in whose honor, sir, I saw your hand right really quickly. Tony Bennett, that's right. Okay. And who is meeting this week in Jackson Hole, Wyoming? Sir. Federal Reserve, central banks, that's right. Okay. Lou Pearlman, he's the founder of boy bands called NSYNC and Backstreet Boys. I mean, you all knew that. You've got it on your head. He died in prison at the age of 62. Why was he in prison? Don't worry, this is not an unsavory thing. Way in the back. He was accused of running convicted of running a Ponzi scheme, which I guess brings in more money than boy bands. What religious figure in America said that Americans would, quote, suffer dire circumstances, unquote, if they did not elect Donald Trump.
Oh, Lord.
Way in back there. Jerry Falwell Jr. carrying on the fine family tradition. And okay, final question. We have one left. Okay. For the win. A Navy sailor. I suppose they're the only ones with sailors. I mean, it's not like... An Air Force sailor. A Navy sailor who says he wanted to show his family where he worked. He was sentenced to a year in prison for doing what? He shared something. Sir? Can't quite accept that, sir.
Picture inside a submarine?
That's right. It was areas in the submarine he wasn't supposed to show.
Wow.
So don't do that if any of you, you know. If you want to do crime, rig an election.
Didn't he try to assert a Hillary Clinton defense?
He said that he wanted to show his family where he worked, which is nice.
I thought it was like a, you know, sort of the... She can have a personal server. I can show.
Oh, yes, he did. He did try that too.
Unsuccessfully.
Listen, yeah. We're going to be back with a lot more news, quiz questions, and much to discuss. Our next program is actually in Silicon Valley on Tuesday, September 13th. And you can find our week-to-week news quiz every week on Huffington Post. Thank you to our panel, Dr. James Taylor, Melissa Kane, and Carson Bruno. Thanks to all of you for coming out tonight. And everyone watching and listening online. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.